Welcome to the Donor Project podcast, where infertility doesn't mean childless. I'm Dr. Miranda Miles, the contemporary conceptionist, and I help women and men using donor eggs bring their baby home sooner. This is what happens when a women's health expert chooses to use donor eggs to create her unique family. Think about the Donor Project podcast as your go-to place for everything you need to know about using donor eggs to bridge the gap between you and your baby. Because every woman deserves the opportunity to be a mum and every man a dad. Welcome to episode 4 of the Donor Project podcast. I am absolutely so thrilled and excited to have the wonderful Dr. Jo Segroy on the show today. Jo is an incredible obstetrician, a gynecologist, IVF and infertility specialist at Epworth Freemasons, St. Vincent's Private, Francis Perry House and Melbourne IVF. Jo assists women and couples to become pregnant and provides the best care and support to them throughout pregnancy and childbirth. He also mentors future generations of doctors in his role as consultant obstetrician and gynecologist at the Royal Women's Hospital and University of Melbourne. Jo is absolutely compassionate and caring, and his main priority is to support patients on both an emotional and medical level. Known as the baby catcher, good afternoon and welcome, Jo.
Good afternoon. How are you, Miranda?
Very well. Thank you so much for joining us today on this wonderful Sunday in Melbourne.
Yeah.
It's a delight to have you on. Thank you. I really wanted to bring you on to talk and help educate women about donor egg processes and what it all involves and how we make it more known that it's an option for women. Because we know one in six couples are struggling with fertility. Many are turning to donor eggs to create their families, and it's just such a great option for people who otherwise may not have children.
Yeah, exactly.
It's it's been an amazing process. Sorry, we're going to say
yeah.
Something.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, a lot of people get on the sort of the merry-go-round or the roller coaster of IVF, utilizing their own either their own eggs or their own sperm. And they're never really told about the prospect of utilizing donor gametes, whether that be donor sperm or donor eggs. And so sometimes probably one of the hardest decisions to make as a couple, and even as a treating physician, is actually saying to a couple, look, you know, I think the best chances of you realizing the dream of becoming parents will be to utilize donor sperm or donor eggs. And I always say to my couples that there's three taxes when it comes to fertility treatment. There's a tax on you physically, there's a tax on you mentally, and there's a tax on you also financially. And I never want to see couples get to the point where they're taxed out on any one of those. So some couples have got an infinite financial resource, right? And they'll just keep going and going and going and going. But that doesn't mean that they're not necessarily going to tax out emotionally or medically.
Absolutely.
And so part of the discussion, about being a good clinician is saying, look, you know what? These are our chances utilizing our own eggs and our own sperm. This is the chance whether we would try with donor eggs or donor sperm. And so maximizing the opportunity of becoming parents, I think, is for some couples anyway, the ultimate goal. Mm. And we always talk about, you know, the difference between nurture and nature. And, you know, so what defines you as a parent will ultimately determine what you feel is the most sensible thing to do in terms of whether you want to proceed down the path of donor.
Mm. So, that's a really such an interesting point. But at what point do you actually say, I think this is your best option? Like, how many rounds of IVF using their own eggs would you actually go, I think it's time?
And that's a very difficult question to answer, isn't it? Because each individual woman and a couple will be unique. And so their circumstances, of course, will be unique. You know, I've got one extreme where I had a woman who was 44 with polycystic ovarian syndrome and was getting, you know, 20, 25 eggs each time. And we were able to create, fortunately, somewhere between 5 to 10 embryos on every one of those cycles. So one would assume, just based on logic and on the statistics, that we would eventually get a chromosomally normal embryo. And irrespective of whether we're 25, 35, 45, the chance of success we always say is related to the woman's eggs, but it's actually related to having a chromosomally normal embryo. So this woman who's 44 with polycystic ovarian syndrome, able to generate a lot of eggs, create a lot of embryos, could test all those embryos and find that one embryo in 10 that was going to be chromosomally normal. And she did on three occasions. Mm. So she became pregnant. So, you know, that's a unique situation for someone who probably could just keep going with multiple cycles of IVF, collecting her own eggs in the hope that she would get a chromosomally normal embryo. Whereas another woman, same, 44 years of age, may only get one or two eggs out of a cycle of IVF and may never make it to day five in terms of an embryo.
Mm.
And that woman may try multiple cycles of IVF to try to get that elusive one egg, but then we've still got to jump the hurdle of that embryo being chromosomally normal.
Mm.
And so for her, the decision to utilise donor eggs may come a lot sooner than that other woman.
That was the position I was in. I was 41 and was only getting one or two eggs every time I did IVF, and I did three rounds of IVF. And they would go to a day five embryo and we transferred and just nothing happened. And because there was I never had any eggs sort of left over, every time I had to do a new egg collection and the tax, as you were saying, the amount that taxed my body and my mental health as well, because it was like, wow, I'm only getting two eggs here. And I wasn't 44, I was only 41. And I know only is an interesting word there. But the moment that I made the decision or found out about the possibility of using donor eggs, it was such an enormous relief to just go, oh my goodness, this, I can actually be a mum. This is possible. And I was quoted, you know, 8% success rate using my own eggs at that time, compared with 50 to 75% using donor eggs. Is that still the statistic that you sort of work on?
Yeah. I mean, you know, ultimately, as I said before, the chance of success relates to the age of the donor or the age of the egg. So, you know, we all know a woman who's less than 35, 70 to 80% of her embryos are going to be chromosomally normal. So every single opportunity then to put in an embryo is going to be around about the 50% chance of pregnancy. So that means that you can weigh things up. And I think having that discussion, I tend to, you know, often I see women and couples who've come to me after seeing another fertility specialist, and it's very easy for me to canvas that discussion early on in our sort of discussions. It is difficult when you've got a couple who are coming newly to pregnancy or newly to fertility treatment at the age of 39, 40, 41 to even broach that issue, because that's not something that's really been on their radar at all. And I think that's the dilemma that, you know, we sort of, you know, there is still not really an awareness of what donor eggs are all about and the utilisation of donor eggs and or sperm. And in actual fact, a lot of what we see in the media is actually negative. And I think there's another article that came out today about a woman who did one of those genetic tests and found out, she thought she was an Ashkenazi Jew, found out that, you know, she was only 49% Ashkenazi, and her other half was Scottish and English. And so she asked her mother, her father had passed away, about, you know, whether she was conceived by donor sperm. And so the article's not canvassed as a good news story, it's canvassed as a bad news story. And so the problem about that is that it then sets up a negative connotation about donor sperm. And it would be nice to change that narrative and you know, say that this was an opportunity of life created and where otherwise it may not have been.
That's exactly. And it is an opportunity of life, but also the opportunity for a mum to be a mum or a dad to be a dad that they just otherwise wouldn't have had. I know that a lot of my patients, when we sort of start talking around donor eggs, there's a lot of my patients obviously ask me, a lot of the time it's the male that will often have the barrier with wanting to use donor eggs, because he's very much, I married you or I'm in love with you, I don't want to use somebody else's eggs. Do you find that can sometimes be a bit of a
I mean, on occasion it has been the male who's been a little bit resistant to I often find it's the other way around. I think in terms of emasculating a bloke, the worst thing you can do is say that you know you have no sperm, or we're not able to utilize any sperm in order to conceive, and you know the only way you guys as a couple will be able to have a child will be to utilize donor sperm. And and you can almost see them deflate in front of you, like they've failed. And that's very disheartening for guys. And you know, I think in this whole fertility, we're so particularly, you know, I try to do this in my own obstetric practice, and I realize that, yes, whilst the woman is the person who's carrying the baby and ultimately will give childbirth, there's this whole other person, her partner, whether it be male or female or best friend, who's also going along that journey as well, and does go through the ups and downs. And the same thing happens with fertility. We're so focused on the woman and her emotional well-being. You know, you'll often see, I had a couple who had a miscarriage the other day, and the woman was actually understood.
Yeah.
Whereas her husband completely lost it. Like absolutely just couldn't understand why that had a miscarriage. And so part of it is also understanding that, you know, there are other partners who are going through the same fertility journey, as well as also the woman who's primarily the person who's going to be involved in the treatment. But so I do find definitely blokes find it a lot difficult when we're talking about donor sperm. In my dealings with couples who have accessed donor eggs, I think, you know, if I think about it, there's probably one or two where the guy is sort of a little bit resistant. And it's often the woman who's come to the point where she feels as though, you know, she needs to make that conscious decision about what it is to her that defines her as a mother, whether it's biology or whether it's actually nurturing a child. And, you know, I think one of the things about utilizing donor eggs, particularly for a woman, is she still gets to carry the baby. This is her baby. You know, she's nurtured that baby for 9 months of its life whilst it's in the womb. She's birthed that baby. You know, she's breastfed that baby if she chooses to breastfeed. You know, that they are not insignificant moments in terms of that child's life. And, you know, the discussion then about later on discussing with the child about, you know, the fact that they are conceived through donor eggs, that's a discussion they'll need to have. But at that point in time, you know, I've not had a woman who's chosen the path regret it. And I suppose that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more about that. People have asked me whether I had any regrets of doing it when I did it, and there's not a single regret at all. And you love that baby like it's your own, because it is. And it's, you know, my children are my blood. They're my soul. They're my essence. People tell me they look like me. And then there's also the microRNA that we have in the uterine fluid that actually influences that genetic expression as well. Yeah, so we do really impact the genes, even though it's not our DNA.
Yeah, and we'll accentuate different characteristics of the child based on how we interact with them. And so
absolutely.
You know, you've got the capacity to be able to influence that child amongst a whole range of things. It's like any child. You know, if you expose them to a whole range of activities, whether it be sporting, theatrics, musical, eventually they'll pick something up. If you never expose them to anything, well, then they'll never go into any direction. So I think that's part of the thing, that your ability and capability in being able to parent will ultimately determine how that child grows up later on.
And family doesn't necessarily require DNA. It just requires love and nurturing and being a good parent.
And I think we need to take a leaf out of, you know, same-sex couples. You know, both, particularly unfortunately in Australia for same-sex female couples, you know, both mothers are mothers.
That's right.
Not one of them. And I suppose they've had an opportunity to, their community has had an opportunity to reconcile that over a period of time. And, you know, hats off to Professor John McBain, who Melbourne IVF took the Catholic Church and the Victorian state government to court on the basis that a single woman couldn't access donor sperm. And that was, I can't remember specifically the date, but, you know, him in conjunction with his patient who wasn't allowed to access donor sperm as a single woman because she wasn't legally divorced from her husband. Because she was legally divorced from her husband, meant that she couldn't be a mother. And so it was from that then that, you know, women in Victoria anyway were able to access donor sperm, single women, and that then went to single same-sex women. And because up until recently, we've been considering same-sex female couples as two single individuals and not a family entity. Unfortunately, with the change in legislation federally about the Marriage Act, now they are a family, and their wife and wife. And so the ability for them to access donor sperm is, you know, equal as it would for a heterosexual couple. But you know, that the community, the same-sex community, has had a long time to reconcile this. Well, you know, it doesn't matter that I'm not biologically linked to my child. I'm still the mother of this child. And I may not even carry the child, but I'm still the mother of the child. Absolutely. And I think that sort of theme and that discussion needs to be brought more broadly accepted amongst the general community.
Well, it's like adoption, isn't it? You know, it's adoptive parents are still that child's parents.
Exactly.
Without, there doesn't have to be that DNA or that genetic connection for you to love a child as much as you do. Okay, so where are we at the moment, Joe, in terms of access to donor eggs now? Like, because it's, the process can be quite hard in Australia to find a donor, to find donor eggs. And Definitely. Then there's the local versus international sort of, you know, where do you go with that? The anonymous versus the non versus the identity reveal. There's so many different elements. So I'm really interested in kind of your take on where things are at. In Australia at the moment.
Sure. Well, some of the most rewarding donor egg experiences that I've been involved with are, you know, a relationship-based donor eggs. So, for example, a friend or a sister or a niece, someone who you know closely, and you know that they're giving the greatest gift they possibly could of being able to allow this couple to be a mother, or the couple to be parents, or the woman to be a mother. They work beautifully. And ultimately, there's a strong bond that is not only between, you know, between the couple, the donor and the recipient, but also a strong bond that's everlasting with the child as well.
Mm.
One of the things that I always encourage my patients to do is just talk about their journey. I have one of my patients who would travel interstate all the time, and she was in a coffee shop and she was just talking to the woman who was serving her about the fact that she's going through fertility treatment and that her doctor had suggested that she utilize donor eggs. And the woman in the coffee shop said, I'd donate my eggs to you.
Oh.
And so it is purely on the basis of having that discussion with people, whoever, if you feel comfortable about having that discussion. And so that's gone on, you know, we've gone on now to have a set of twins as a result of that relationship. So you know, I think first of all, if you feel comfortable and confident in your decision, then don't shy away from it and start telling people that this is the path that you're choosing, because you never know, you may find someone who is happy to be involved in that process. So certainly those relationships where you know someone, whether it be a friend, a family member, they're going to be quite easier, I suppose, to access, and certainly a lot of reward for both the donor and the recipient, and of course the child as well. It does become a little bit harder then in Australia to be able to access locally acquired eggs. You can't necessarily advertise, you can't reimburse costs, but you can't pay for eggs. So in other words, we can't traffic organs, and we can't traffic eggs or sperm. So that in itself is not so much a problem, but it means that the access to locally acquired eggs is quite low. And the fact that in order to donate eggs, it needs to be altruistic. So there can't be a reason you're doing it beyond the fact that you're just doing it for a genuine purpose, i.e. to help a couple or a woman achieve pregnancy. And I was saying earlier that, you know, it's a lot easier for a bloke, you know, and certainly more time efficient to donate, you know, 100 million sperm. But for a woman to donate, you know, anywhere between 10 to 20 eggs, it is a task in terms of her time, in terms of the commitment, in terms of the drugs that she needs to inject, and also the surgical procedures she needs to undertake in order to collect the eggs. So, there is a time commitment. It's not a huge time commitment, and that's partly because people see IVF as onerous. But the reality of the situation is anyone who's done IVF will know that they're still going to work during the process, and the only day they're taking off is the day that they need to do the egg collection. So it's a time commitment, yes, but it's not an onerous time commitment. So locally acquired eggs is quite hard. Melbourne IVF is now in the process of cementing a donor hub. We've got legislative requirements across the whole of Australia, which are very different in terms of our ability and capability to, number one, import eggs, and also about the legislative requirements with respect to counselling and anonymity. And so in Victoria, and also part of the Virtus Health Network, which includes Queensland Fertility Group, IVF Australia, Tasmania, Victoria, and Melbourne IVF, we're importing now eggs from the World Egg Bank. So that'll allow an opportunity for women to access overseas donors who undertake the same legislative requirements as they are in Australia. And then lastly, of course, is the ability, if they're, not at the moment, obviously with COVID, it's become somewhat difficult, but to be able to go overseas. And most IVF specialists will have developed a relationship with clinics overseas, whether that, I've got close connections with Greece, South Africa, Russia, the UK, sorry, not the UK, Spain. Spain, Taiwan. So there's places where we can go overseas in order to at least access donor eggs. Now, of course, with COVID at the moment, it is making it a little bit difficult. But for women who are nearing the end of their reproductive life, and what I mean by that is donor eggs, generally speaking, up to the age of 50, in some cases 52, I have had a couple of women already during this lockdown period and COVID restrictions in terms of border closures who have already started travelling to Greece. The issue with that is really a couple of things. Number one, I provide a letter of support. They try to get a letter of support from their local member of parliament. We then contact Home Affairs. Home Affairs then hopefully says it's possible. And then they'll go overseas for treatment. Of course, there's the additional cost not only of treatment and flights getting over there, but then quarantine on the way back. So that's added a level of complexity that unfortunately wasn't there beforehand.
I had one of my patients go to Greece. She went November, December. So sort of the borders would have opened a little bit, but it was still pretty tough and quarantined at both ends of the time. Her first transfer failed, so then they chose another donor while they're over there, and they ended up being there for about 3.5 months because they just sort of went, well, it's not worth coming back because it's so hard to get there, so we'll just stay. And they were in a kind of privileged position where they could do that, but not everybody's able to just take 3.5 months.
It was certainly easier prior to COVID because I'd say to couples, look, you know what, I'll prepare everything here.
Yeah,
you go overseas, you have the transfer,
yeah,
and go on a holiday for 2 or 3 weeks, right?
That's what we did.
And if it doesn't work, then you've got the opportunity for another transfer straight away without having to fly backwards and forwards from Australia. It is difficult now. And of course, naturally, a lot of us are worried about just roaming the streets of Greece or South Africa or Spain, particularly in light of the fact that there's these variant strains of COVID. So you can't lock yourself up in a hotel for 3 or 4 months, and it does become a little bit difficult. And look, that's one of the great shames in terms of this whole the COVID thing has impacted so many people across so many different spectrums. And this is just bar one of a group of people who have been impacted.
That's right. So if somebody wanted to see you, Joe, and go through the donor process, what sort of time frame? And you said that you have access to be bringing eggs in from the World Egg Bank. What sort of time frame are we sort of talking with that? And how easy is it at the moment?
Yeah, so it's becoming easier as we've gained contractual arrangements with the World Egg Bank to import eggs. So as of May this year, it should be relatively seamless.
Right.
Number one, of course, accessing the donor list and working out who the donor you wish to select. And then the process pretty much, within 1 to 2 months of obviously counselling, making sure that you guys as a couple are ready and also understand the commitments and so on and so forth. And then obviously putting in place a plan in order to, prepare the uterus and prepare the lining of the womb in preparation for an embryo transfer. So, look, where women and couples were spending a lot of money going overseas, I'd always make sure that the uterus was well prepared beforehand. And so I'd always do something called an endometrial receptivity assay for women who are going overseas, partly because you're about to spend not only the amount of money for the donor eggs and the IVF cycle, but in addition to that, obviously flights and accommodation. Mm. And I just want to make sure 100% that the embryo was going in at exactly the right time that it should do. Mm. I know, for example, there is a woman who came and saw me. She's now had a couple of babies, and she had gone to Greece 7 times for donor eggs. And then eventually, I don't know how she heard about me. She heard about me. She came and saw me. We did this endometrial receptivity assay, and we found out that she actually needed, rather than 5 full days of progesterone before the transfer on the 6th day, that she actually needed 7 days of progesterone before the transfer on the 8th day. So that just that one change, fly overseas and get pregnant. So yes, the endometrial receptivity assay, not fully validated in science. We can't be 100% certain that it's correct. It is an additional tool that we often use in general fertility treatment and general fertility medicine. But at the end of the day, if it provides that information where you're about to spend a whole lot of money to appropriately time the embryo transfer, then I think it's well worth doing. And so that requires an additional month of preparation before the transfer, the actual. So it's almost like having a dummy cycle, making sure everything works before we put the embryo in.
Yeah, fantastic. I wound up with 3 trips to Thailand for my first, with my first donor. And the very, very first time was when Charlie was conceived. So it worked, but we had 3 more embryos over there, and they never took. And then we did 4 trips to Malaysia. So all in 1 year to get my daughter. So it was, anything you can do to short circuit that and make it a bit quicker, absolutely 100% is a good thing.
And even simple things, like I had a woman who'd had her first child in South Africa through donor eggs. Mm. And she initially went to South Africa where she commenced her progesterone. So, I don't know what the time difference, I can't remember it now, but let's say it's 18 hours difference, the difference between South Africa and Australia. So when she was starting her progesterone in South Africa, she appropriately had 5 days and transferred on the 6th. Then she did another 3 or 4 cycles with another fertility specialist before coming to see me. And I said to her, well, the first one worked. Every other time you're doing it, you're starting it. And then I worked out that she was starting Australian time. So she was actually having more progesterone than she required. Then she would fly over because she had the embryos over there. So I said to her, let's just tweak one thing. And that is you only start the progesterone on South African time, as you did with your first daughter. She did that, she got pregnant. So part of it is just winding back and saying, well, what happened in the first one? Why did you get pregnant the first one as compared to the other 3 that you've now done? And that was the only thing that I could see that had changed. So we just shifted it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Something so seemingly simple and small, that's an enormous
enormous impact. I mean, cost in flights.
Exactly.
It was a whole range. And, the doctors over in South Africa probably didn't think about it either. So no one thought about it. You only need 5 days. Start 7 o'clock Australian time on a Wednesday, and you should transfer on the Monday South African time. Well, okay, but that's not the same.
Timing doesn't work. Work. That's quite incredible.
Yeah.
So another question for you. So if somebody is going to do donor eggs with you, how many, and we're using the World Egg Bank, how many profiles would they get? How how many donors?
Now that I'm not certain of, because as I said, we're only starting as of May the 1st.
Yeah, perfect.
The World Egg Bank.
So that's new, Joe. That's really new.
That's brand new. Myself and Fleur Cottrell are the two doctors from Melbourne IVF who are currently sitting on the reference committee.
Awesome.
And it'll be done through Tasmanian IVF. We do have a competitor that brings in eggs through the World Egg Bank, and unfortunately their contract's going to be expiring soon. So that's part of an issue for them. So Varta here in Victoria won't probably extend the contract with the World Egg Bank. Look, I think legislators, and I mean that politicians and our authorities, are really behind the times when it comes to this whole issue of donor eggs and surrogacy.
Yeah.
You know, we protect, what we think we're doing is we're protecting women from exploitation here in Australia. You know, don't sell your eggs because, of course, that's exploiting women. What we find, of course, is that some couples are accessing treatment in countries where there's no regulation. We don't know whether there's any exploitation or not.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, we have no control about the appropriate counselling. I'll give you a classic example. A couple that I know had gone overseas for donor eggs. And the partner had just coincidentally, when they went over there, they never had any fertility work up here in Australia. But when they got over there, the husband had no sperm. And so within a 2-minute decision, right, the couple were asked, do you want to use donor sperm? I mean, of course, what are they going to do? They've just spent all this money going overseas to go and access donor eggs. That's what they thought their primary concern was. Because she was older, and that was the only thing they thought was wrong. And someone suggested, don't do anything in Australia, just go overseas. Husband didn't have any sperm, bang. Within a split second, they were making a decision to do donor sperm. Mm. So, you know, I think personally, my feeling is that the reimbursement in terms of costs shouldn't just go to the tram ticket that's required in order to come to the fertility clinic. It shouldn't go to, you know, the antihistamine they needed because they got a localized skin reaction.
Mm.
It should go to the time, the medical risk they've gone through in order to actually donate eggs. And I think that's part of the issue. And even with a surrogate, for example, the same thing. I mean, the surrogate goes through 40 weeks of gestating. I mean, even if you said, let's pay her a cent an hour, you know, that's nothing, right? And I just think at the end of the day, we do need to realise that it is, yeah, sure, it should be done altruistically, but there should also be an acknowledgement that there is a risk to personal health, well-being and safety.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we should value that as a community.
Mm.
And we should realise that, you know, at the end of the day, it is giving an opportunity, again, to life, as we've discussed earlier, but also to a couple and a woman to become a parent or a parent.
Mm. And it's, you know, as we talked about earlier, women are ovulating, you know, basically every month, every 28, 29 days, and there's all of these beautiful eggs that if they could just be donated, would help so many other couples, so many other women. And if there was that ability to actually reward them in some way, I think would open it up a little bit more, don't you think?
Yeah, look, I mean, we're probably in a fortunate position, or we will be in a fortunate position, hopefully in 5 to 10 years, because there will be a whole group of women who have frozen their eggs electively for fertility preservation, who may never go on to use them.
That's true.
And the prospect is for them to be reimbursed at least for the storage costs of those eggs.
Yeah.
And perhaps those women, after appropriate counselling, will see that, you know, whilst they've not needed them, that there would be need in terms of other couples or other women rather, to utilise those eggs.
Mm.
It's difficult to know whether that will happen. I mean, even in our own clinical setting where we've got lots of embryos that are in storage, it's very, you know, it still takes a lot for a couple to make a decision to donate an embryo.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think it'll be for every woman that they'll be happy to donate their eggs, but there'll be some women who will be happy to do so, yeah?
I'm in that situation at the moment. I have 7 embryos in Malaysia, and I can't, like, we can't get there at the moment. We don't know if we will ever use them again either, but there are seven embryos sitting there, and I'm sort of in that compromised position, it feels, where I'm sort of going, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do with them. And that's it. I would love to think that I will get to the point where I'll be able to donate them. And I've seen that, you know, lots of women do that. I have another really interesting sort of element with my own story, in that my donor, I put her in contact with another Australian woman living in Spain. And she did end up getting pregnant with my donor, or my donor's eggs. And so my daughter has a half sister to another Australian woman in Spain. And we just email, you know, every year, just email each other, hey, going, send photos, and hope one day that our two daughters will get to meet. And it's really lovely. It's such a beautiful experience, and a beautiful thing to know that Matilda has another sibling on the other side of the world. And the sense of community that creates, and just a bond between the mother and I, and we've never met. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's where I'd love to think that I'd be able to donate the current embryos I have as well. We're just not sure if we're going to use them though.
And I think that's the dilemma. There's always a sense of, you know, will we use them in the future? But it is going to be, you know, it's incumbent on us, again, to raise awareness, I think.
Yes.
And it's part of one of the reasons why I'm active on social media, and I also do media per se, in order to raise the awareness of donor eggs. And of course, there will be that discussion that we'll have with those women who have frozen their eggs in the future about whether they wish to donate their eggs as well. So it's going to be, you know, hopefully a different story sooner rather than later. But at the moment, it is extraordinarily difficult, and not, and as I said before, not helped by politicians who don't have, who I suppose have never understood or fully don't understand the what the ramifications of it are. And you'd love it for Dan Andrews to be, you know, his wife and himself to have had problems with respect to donor eggs, because then he would understand the implications that it has in terms of couples accessing it, and perhaps it would be legislative changes. But of course, until it actually hits someone emotionally and emotively, then they're not going to do that.
And it's amazing how many women or couples, women and or couples, have actually gone through this process with such little awareness. So there's, I think people would be surprised to know how many people have actually gone through a donor egg process. I think it's more than what we actually think, but it's still so difficult. So lots of people are touched emotionally, but you know, we need the politicians to be touched emotionally.
Yeah. And look, prior to COVID, there's probably two or three women a month that I was helping going overseas in order to access donor eggs. I mean, that's completely stopped now. There's no women obviously accessing donor eggs per se completely. So, and you got a feel for that, because, you know, whilst not all of them would have been pregnant, that's 36, at least a good proportion of them wouldn't be. So let's say 50%. So that's 15 women who unfortunately, just through my practice, haven't been able to become mothers.
Yeah, and that's really, really sad. And as we talked about before, you know, COVID has touched so many different groups, you know, in whatever way, but also the whole donor process has been kind of turned on its head, and women have been very affected by that.
Definitely.
Very, very hard. Joe, I wanted to ask you, there was a couple of questions that came through that I was asked to ask you. One was, do you feel that a fresh or a frozen donor egg transfer is better? Do you have any kind of opinion with that, or is it the same as IVF?
It's similar to IVF. Look, as I said before, I tend to do this endometrial receptivity assay ahead of doing the embryo transfer, which is on an artificial medicated Thaw cycle.
Yeah.
Therefore, you've got to remember that a woman effectively is having a Thaw. It doesn't really matter, because it's just an embryo. And in those scenarios where the recipient is receiving the embryo, one of the reasons we have this issue about whether a fresh embryo transfer is good or bad, or whether or not whether a thaw cycle is better, is based purely around a woman who's gone through the stimulation protocol of having eggs collected.
Yep.
Got to remember that the environment, the uterine environment, the hormones the woman has during a stimulated cycle of IVF to go collect her eggs is not normal. There's super physiological doses of estrogen and progesterone. And so when we're placing an embryo in that environment, we're not certain that it's natural. It's totally artificial. So that's so there's always this dilemma about fresh and frozen transfers for a woman who's utilizing her own eggs. It's very different, though, when you're doing a donor to a recipient. So the woman who's getting the egg, she will not be in a cycle of IVF where she's super stimulated and there's going to be these abnormal hormone levels. And so whether you put in a fresh embryo or a frozen embryo is not going to matter in that regard.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought, thought about it in that way. But we do want to make sure that uterine microbiome is still beautiful in the recipient. And that's a lot of the work that I do with my patients is getting them ready, you know, for that 3 to 4 months. Even though we're using donor eggs, clearly we don't need to make any changes to egg quality for the recipient, but certainly the uterine lining, the microbiome, you know, we still need all of that right as well, which I think sometimes women can forget that. And not only that, but also making sure that the sperm is, you know, good quality sperm. We don't want to mix crappy sperm in with beautiful 20-something-year-old donor eggs.
Exactly right. So, I mean, it's still there's still a preparation that needs
absolutely
to be done in terms of pregnancy and becoming healthy for pregnancy and allowing that embryo the best opportunity it has to be able to become pregnant. And I think the microbiome is something that's poorly understood at the moment. Yeah. And, you know, I did a post on it myself where I talked about, you know, needing to have healthy bacteria within the environment of the uterus and understanding that if you've got an abnormal amount of bacteria within the uterus, then the immune system is armed up. And so you can imagine this immune system is like an army attacking the bad bacteria. And along comes this little embryo that gets caught up in the crossfire, so to speak. So if we can make sure that the uterine environment is normal and therefore the immune system's not armed up, when that embryo does implant, it's got the best opportunity to be able to achieve pregnancy.
Definitely. I saw your video on that. That was fabulous. It was very well explained so that people could sort of, get their head around that. The other question I was asked to ask you is, does blood type matter when you're choosing a donor? Do you need to have the same blood group as your donor? That was another question that came through.
No, not at all. No. I mean, it's interesting how our bodies are, you've got to imagine that this little embryo, which is beginning to become a baby, is a parasite. And, you know, it's sitting inside your uterus and it's sucking the life forces out of you. But our immune system is quite good, or the female immune system is quite good. It allows this embryo to implant, but not to invade. And so, you know, you can have, you know, and there'll be, people will know this. They might be blood group O and their baby's blood group A positive. A. So you have no, you don't need to have a donor, therefore, that has exactly the same blood group as you do, because your babies generally don't have the same blood group as their mums.
That's right. Beautiful. Thank you. And then I did have one other question as well. Do you think that a donor egg conceived pregnancy, like, so we're now in the pregnancy stage, are there different complications from using a donor egg in pregnancy compared with using your own eggs? Is the pregnancy itself impacted?
So I think the process of doing IVF, whether it be utilising your own eggs and thawing out an embryo and putting that embryo in, or alternatively having a uterus prepared and putting a donor embryo in, are not dissimilar. And so we know through studies that there are additional concerns that we have with any IVF pregnancy.
Yep.
Babies can be born a bit smaller. These are higher chances of cesarean section rates due to placental insufficiency, small increased chances of things like preeclampsia or gestational hypertension, high blood pressure towards the latter part of pregnancy. So there's no doubt that there are things that are related specifically just to the fertility process.
Yes.
The other issue, of course, is that women who are generally accessing donor eggs tend to be older.
Yes.
And of course, with an older pregnancy, and we talk about this as advanced maternal age, but you know, it's just you're older. Nothing to worry about. And as I become older, it's less, you know, you're younger. So I don't really care. the issue is, you know, in terms of a pregnancy in an older woman. So high blood pressure, again, preeclampsia, gestational diabetes. These are the sort of things. And look, you know, I think whether you see a private obstetrician or whether you go to a public hospital in order to have your pregnancy care, the hospital or the doctor is going to be conscious of those concerns and obviously monitor the baby a lot more closely and, of course, monitor the woman a lot more closely as well. Look, I'm in a very unique position when I see a couple for fertility treatment, irrespective of whether they're doing donor eggs or they're doing their own fertility journey. I'm not looking at just trying to get the woman pregnant. I'm also then thinking about what's going to happen during the pregnancy. Because the vast majority of my patients will stay on for pregnancy care. So it is about looking at them from a medical perspective, as well as also from a fertility perspective and from an obstetric perspective, so that all those three things marry together as we move forward from fertility into pregnancy and then childbirth. Mm. And that's unique because I think a lot of fertility specialists just focus on that positive HCG, the pregnancy test, and see you later.
Mm.
And I think that's why, you know, in a way, my practice is somewhat restrained a little bit, because I might say to a woman, look, there are a few things that need to be corrected before we do get you pregnant, because I just don't want a positive HCG and a fetal heart rate at 6 weeks. I want to be able to see you run around with your toddler.
Exactly. We want a live birth at the end of all of this.
Correct. Yeah. And so a lot of it may be saying, you know what, for the benefit of what's going to happen in terms of the pregnancy, reduction in high blood pressure, reduction in diabetes, let's lose some weight, let's concentrate on the 100 days beforehand, make sure everything's really squeaky clean before we become pregnant.
Yeah.
Because that's going to stand us in good stead when we're a mother.
Yeah. I developed preeclampsia myself with both of the pregnancies, and it was a little bit kind of unexpected because I'm very small and my blood pressure is generally very, very low, but it was quite, it happened really quickly. 1 week I was fine. The next week it was just, I had all the symptoms. I was biochemically and symptomatically had preeclampsia, and it was, you know, emergency cesarean, off we go. And I do wonder if they're not only the risk with age there, because of course I was 42 and 46 with both of my pregnancies, but also the fact that it's, do you think that because it's donor material, like it's a donor egg, plus the sperm is kind of foreign as well to, you know, the recipient's body, do you think that impacts as well? Because it's this, there's none of the material was mine, my DNA, my genetics.
Yeah, look, we really, to be honest, we don't fully understand the immune system and the way the placenta implants at the time of an embryo. That whole process of preeclampsia really is centered around implantation and how well the placenta develops good blood vessels in order to maintain a healthy placenta. You know, most, if not all, my patients will be on low-dose aspirin and calcium in their pregnancy in order to mitigate against the risk of preeclampsia.
Mm.
Of course, it's not going to completely stop it.
Mm.
And so that the lack of knowledge, therefore, means that we can't easily predict. We can certainly do some biochemistry tests. We can do some ultrasounds early on in pregnancy to give us an understanding of whether there a woman is at a heightened risk of preeclampsia. But ultimately, you know, in my practice, I make an assumption that anyone could develop preeclampsia any time. And so doing those tests really, or, you know, it's a bit like saying, oh, look, you might get hit by a car today. Well, the whole day you're just going to be freaking out. Just make sure that every day you look to the left and look to the right before you cross the road. Yeah. I mean, that's the most important thing, isn't it? Just live your life cautious each time. So, you know, part of doing those tests doesn't change my management. I still see my patients. I still do a blood pressure. I still ask them the same questions about whether they develop symptoms. So, look, whether there's an immune, there's definitely stuff that we don't know in terms of an immunological component of implantation that, you know, probably will be borne out with science over the course of the next decade or two.
Yeah, I think so. After I had Matilda, my obstetrician said that I've got some slightly different immune globulin now in my bloodstream that wasn't there before. And he sort of had no idea why, how. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of the immune system we kind of don't really understand, which, again, is why it's so important to do that 100 days of preparation to sort of keep the immune response as moderated and regulated as possible for a pregnancy.
Definitely.
Joe, thank you so much. We have been talking for about an hour. It's been an absolute pleasure and delight to have you on my podcast. I was so happy when you said you would do it. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so I mean, if you follow Instagram, obviously you can follow me on Instagram at Dr. Joseph. Obviously, like the intro, at Epworth Freemasons is where I practice through Melbourne IVF, and most of the babies I capture at the Epworth as well, St. Pete's. So more than happy to see anyone if they want.
I will put all of that in the show notes as well. I'm going to let you go and enjoy your Sunday afternoon.
Same to you.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye for now.
Bye. Bye. Bye.